This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we begin with a conversation about capitalism's relationship with democracy and fascism in the U.S. today.
Our guest is Professor Richard Wolff, who the New York Times has said is probably America's most able Marxist economist.
We talked with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges about his book, American Fascist. Is there still time to halt the growing fascistic movement in America and preserve a meaningful measure of our threatened democracy?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. The great German playwright and political figure Bertolt Brecht observed that to understand fascism, you have to understand capitalism from whence it springs. Today, it is also helpful to us to understand that the rise of fascism in Germany 100 years ago has parallels that we can now see with respect to the rise of fascism here in the United States. Prior to World War I, which began in 1914, the German working class and middle class were relatively prosperous. The German unions were strong and influential. Prior to World War I, Germany also had the largest and strongest socialist party in the world, and it was the second largest political party in the German parliament. The German economy was booming, and German culture was the jewel of Europe. This all came to a crashing end in 1917, when Germany was defeated in what was an inter-imperial war against the United States, France, Great Britain, and Russia. The consequences of that defeat brought us fascism and World War II 20 years later. In the 1920s, inflation wiped out the savings of the German people, and when the Depression hit in 1929, the German working class was desperate. The ground was fertile for the rise of Adolf Hitler, a ruthless, cunning, and violent demagogue. Here in the United States, our economy boomed for 100 years, from the end of the Civil War until the 1970s. But since then, American workers have not made any progress. Their wages, in fact, in real terms, have not risen in 50 years. Neoliberalism, which is just another word for aggressive capitalism, has wiped out 30 million industrial jobs in the United States starting in the 1980s. Women were driven back into the workforce. People had to work two jobs just to keep up. In Germany, it was the Jews who were blamed. Here in the United States, it is immigrants and people of color who are scapegoated. The demagogue Trump, like Hitler before him, is a captivating speaker and a very effective cult leader, who is now poised to take the power of the government and turn it against we the people. So we will talk today with our returning guest economist, Richard Wolff, Professor Wolff from the University of Massachusetts and the author of the forthcoming book, Understanding Capitalism. According to the New York Times, Richard Wolff is, and I quote, probably America's most prominent Marxist economist. Well, Richard Wolff, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
All right, sir. Now, Richard, you know, you've so held much of your life, your intellectual life, certainly studying, teaching, writing about capitalism. And in fact, you have a new book coming out titled Understanding Capitalism. So let's talk about capitalism's relationship to democracy and relationship to fascism here in the U.S. and, of course, 100 years ago in Germany.
My pleasure. I'd be glad to. It's, you know, it's one of those urgent topics that almost escapes attention because it either overwhelms people or they think it's ancient history, and it isn't. It's very applicable to the immediate crises that we face.
So explain that to us. Why do you believe that is the case?
Well, capitalism is a system that has built into it at least two fundamental qualities that produce one crisis after another. And the first of those qualities is inequality. In other words, capitalism is a system that produces extreme wealth at one end, you know, Elon Musk's and people like that, and then a vast army of people who are barely make ends meet, which is, you know, the bottom two-thirds of the American people, and the same is true in most other capitalist countries. When you produce inequality like that, and you reproduce it generation by generation, you also produce enormous social tension. On the part of the mass of people, you produce bitterness, anger, resentment, envy, all of those things that go into being on the short end of the stick and seeing your parents in that position and your children in that position. On the other hand, among the few who are rich, you get this kind of anxiety that they understand very well that they are the rich surrounded by a sea of people who are bitter about it. And so they turn to the police and the military, desperate to protect what they have against all. In other words, built into this system is a level of conflict and tension that periodically explodes. And the forms of explosion go everywhere from the individual act of violence against a family member, against a neighbor, against a coworker, when the pressures of being in debt and the pressures of being unable to afford to put food on the table blow up a person's tolerability. We are all human. We can only take so much. Then there are revolutions. Then there are workers who go on strike. But on the other side of the coin, then there are the people who want a government that will protect them, that will have the streets full of police and military, monitoring everything we do, controlling everything we do, punishing the slightest infraction. And when that process goes far enough, you call it fascism. It takes that particular form in which the government is brought in as a kind of day-by-day partner to the business community, the employer class, to impose and enforce the capitalist system because the mass of people either don't want it, don't stand it, can't tolerate it, or are beginning to rumble that they want change. And capitalism keeps producing it. It produced it in Europe in the last century multiple times. We had it in the 1930s so badly, in the names of Mussolini and Hitler and others, that we had a world war, killed, you know, 40, 50 million people coming out of the challenge of fascism to try to become the next phase of human history. So it's always lurking, and it always looks at beginnings of tension as a chance to justify its argument that you have to do that to save the people at the top. You know, in Germany, this was all organized around demonizing Jews and certain other groups of minorities. Nowadays, it's organized around demonizing immigrants and other minorities. It always finds some scapegoats because it doesn't want to answer the question, why is our society torn apart, by answering, it's our capitalist system, because that's a taboo. And so you look for an alternative explanation, and then there are the usual scapegoats, and that's what fascism distinguishes itself about. It goes after those scapegoats and literally kills them.
Rick, what did the economic policies of neoliberalism do to the American working class?
Well, the major thing, there are several. Economic liberalism, for lack of a better term, something that became dominant again in the 1970s. It had been dominant earlier. By the way, that's why it's called neoliberalism, because it's the newer version, but it's an old business. This is the idea that the economy will work best if you leave it in the hands of the employer class. The U.S. Census today says 3% of the American people are employers. The rest of us are employees. So in other words, if you leave you take liberalism seriously, then you put into the driver's seat of society the 3% of people who employ the rest of us. And that idea leads you then to have the very inequalities I just mentioned. And you also have, very serious, a kind of built-in instability. Every 4 to 7 years, capitalist economic systems everywhere in the world crash. Sometimes the economic downturn, and by the way, it's called a recession or a depression or a crisis or a correction. I mean, they're endless terms because this is always with us in capitalism. Every 4 to 7 years, sometimes it only lasts a few months. Sometimes it lasts 10 years. Sometimes it only throws 1 million people out of work. Sometimes it throws 50 million people out of work. In other words, capitalism is a system that not only produces and reproduces huge inequality, it's also unstable. And unstable on a scale and on a level that makes people really bitter and angry. And what you saw over the last 30 to 40 years, the neoliberalism, that corporations got the control here in America. They pushed back on what the New Deal had achieved. They undid the New Deal in the 40 years afterwards. And then they went to town and they did three crucial things. Number one, they moved production out of the United States to other parts of the world where labor was cheaper, above all Asia and above all China.
Number two, they replaced expensive workers with automation, the computer, the robot, and now artificial intelligence.
These two things destroyed tens of millions of jobs and dumped the people who lost those jobs into very bad situations for themselves, for the families that depended on them, for the communities that depended on those families. And you basically split the United States into the minority that did well by moving production to Europe, or to Asia, excuse me, and the majority that are looking around trying to figure out what happened. That's why Mr. Trump is successful with a slogan like MAGA, because it's a fancified notion of a good old days that are now gone. The good old days weren't that good, and they didn't disappear by some magic. That was a decision of capitalists in America to go to where the profit was highest, which is what they always do, and now it meant leaving the United States, and the working class is stuck with the result. It's very bitter, and so the ruling class has to turn to fascistic ways of keeping control. That's what the Trump administration and the Trump campaign is all about. That's what the 2025 plan is all about. These are the steps taken when the capitalist system once again finds the inequality and the instability bringing to the edge of the sustainability of their system, and then they turn to force, to violence, in a word, to fascism.
Richard, following along on what you were just talking about, and you mentioned Trump, he, of course, has the political and financial support of, well, Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, both billionaires 100 times over, and a lot of folks like him. And for that matter, Harris has the support of Wall Street, too. Talk to us again about why they enjoy that kind of support, what that really means.
I'll be diplomatic. The employer class of our country understood that they don't want to be altogether identified with one party or the other party. The reason is that then the working class might figure out that the way to defeat the employer class, to make their wages better, to make their job security stronger, and so on, was to line up behind the other party. The whole origin of socialist political parties in Europe and here in the United States was premised on the notion that since the vast majority of people are in the working class, socialism should appeal to them. It's what's for them rather than for the capitalists. and so that they would organize a political party. The risk, of course, was that the mass of workers would understand it that way, too, and would vote for the Socialist Party, which in many parts of the world, including here in the United States, large numbers of workers did. If you go back to the American Socialist Party, Eugene Victor Debs, socialist parties in the 1930s, they were beginning to pick up large numbers of sympathies and voters and all the rest. So the people at the top understood, how about a better system? We have two parties, and we make the whole political system be a contest between the two, but we make both of them dependent on us, so that neither of them can afford to alienate us, to upset us, to pursue laws or rules or regulations that limit or constrain us. We'll make them both us, and therefore we can throw out one when people get antsy and bring in the other one. And then when nothing really changes and they get angry at the one we brought in, we say, okay, we'll give you the other party. And we go back and forth in exactly the way that the Republicans and Democrats have been doing for years in this country. And I think that's what you see. You get the Democratic Party is dependent on huge donors that are of one frame of mind, and the Republican Party is on the other. So that the one thing that the candidates on both sides have in common is they never have a critical word to say about capitalism. If you think about it, it's actually extraordinary. They will talk about a problem over here or there in housing or in tariffs or in price gouging or whatever else they might occasionally talk about. But when they do, it's never the capitalist system that is part of the problem, let alone the key part of the problem. And so they come up with little piecemeal reforms and suggestions, which either pass or don't, and in any case do not solve the problem. I mean, let me give you just one stark example. The minimum wage in this country, the federal minimum wage, is $7.25 an hour. That was last raised to that lofty level in the year 2009. That's 15 years ago. During every one of the 15 years since then, prices have gone up in the United States for milk and eggs and coffee and gasoline and everything else. But what we pay the poorest of the poor workers in America remained the same, $7.25, so they could, of course, afford less and less with each passing year. Republican presidents did that. Democratic presidents did it. Republican Congresses did it. Democratic Congresses did it. Somehow, with all the differences we're supposed to believe exist between them, when it came to something that a lot of capitalists want, namely cheap labor, suddenly magic, they couldn't find a disagreement about it. It's really extraordinary when you watch it. We have no opposition to capitalism that's allowed to play any kind of role. We have a duopoly, a system of politics that makes it impossible for third parties to get off the ground. And that's carefully done to make sure that this theater, in which you have a debate, in which you can say with a straight face that you're worried about immigrants eating pets, but you cannot discuss capitalism. That is weird in a world in which capitalism is everywhere, understood to be a system in a lot of problem and a lot of crisis right now.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with Jim Lafferty, my former law partner. The two of us are co-hosting Law and Disorder, and we're speaking with the economist Richard Wolff, who's just written a book called Understanding Capitalism, a wonderful book. Rick, the countervailing forces that could potentially fight fascism in this country are fairly weak, but they exist. There's an upsurge in the union movement. The Palestine solidarity efforts are remarkable. We had the Black Lives Matter movement, and the Occupy movement. This brought about the popular notion of the 1% as opposed to the rest of us, the 99%. And lately we had the Bernie Sanders phenomena. Socialism is no longer a dirty word in America. How do you appreciate all of this?
More and more of these young people, and particularly the young, but the older ones too, they are really demanding change. The old socialist dream, which always was expressible in this phrase, we can do better than capitalism. That instinct is what took people who lived in slavery and finally allowed them to say, we've had it with this system, it has to go. And it did. And the same thing happened with the serfs in feudalism. This has to go. And it did. And we shouldn't be all that surprised that sooner or later, after perhaps a dozen false starts, a mass movement will say, we can do better than capitalism. We don't have to divide ourselves into 3% of the people who are employers and 97% who are employees, so that the employers enrich themselves, keep the power for themselves. And we're all wondering how secure our job is, whether we can give an education to our children. This is not a necessary way, any more than slavery was necessary or serfdom was necessary. And I think you're seeing that. And I think those movements that you mentioned are precisely the signs in various communities that sooner or later, this system's contradictions will blow it up. The labor movement isn't new. You know, it's 100 years old, 200 years old in this country and older in Europe. They've been fighting the employer for a long time. They've had a longer history, and they've done better, by the way, than American workers have. I want to remind everyone that we here in this country don't have what working class struggles, usually led by socialists, were able to achieve, for example, in Western Europe. I'm still amazed as a professor, born and raised in America and taught in American universities all my life, when I explain that in France, for example, when you graduate high school and you take a job, the law requires the employer to give you 5 weeks of paid vacation from day one. Doesn't depend on who your union is or isn't. Doesn't depend on who your employer is. It's the law. Socialists got that law. Higher education in Western Europe, in France, in Germany, is effectively free. No tuition, no fees. Why? Because the socialist movement fought for those things. Americans can't even imagine it. And that's partly because the socialism has been kept at bay by defining politics as if it went no further than what you saw last night.
And certainly you've made the point that both of the political parties that dominate the scene in this country, the Republicans and Democrats, they're both capitalist parties. And both of the candidates for president, whether it be Donald Trump or Kamala Harris, are also have that philosophy, that political economic philosophy. But in the context of the growing fear of fascism in this country, do you not think there is a qualitative political difference there between Trump and Harris? I know a good many people on the left do. They argue there is a great deal of a difference. They say, well, you know, Trump, along with the fascistic nationalism of that Project 2025 report that you referenced, would represent, if you were elected, a further big, dangerous step towards fascism in America, or at the very least, the coming of an authoritarian president if Trump is elected. So what are your thoughts on that, given that, nevertheless, both candidates are themselves capitalists from capitalist parties?
Well, my sense is the following. Sometimes the little difference is the only difference you can grab hold of, and I think we're in that situation. Mr. Trump seems to be very comfortable imagining a fascistic turn in the United States, especially one with him at the helm. He idolizes leaders around the world who have also taken steps in that direction. He clearly is a Republican. He clearly favors capital over labor. He doesn't understand most of the issues that are involved there other than from an employer point of view. So, yeah, I think he would be the easiest, quickest convert to a fascistic solution as the problems arise for which this capitalism in America is so poorly prepared to deal. I think the difference is that Kamala Harris would take a little longer. She might be a bit more hesitant to make those moves. If you're asking me, is she capable of ending up in a similar place? I don't have the slightest doubt that she is. She has been part of this system all of her life, certainly all of her adult life, and there's no reason to doubt that she would. But I think that the real question is, and that has always been the case, will the mass of the people allow either of them, and I mean either of them, to go in that direction? The union movement isn't going to do that. Black Lives Matter isn't going to do that. The Palestinian people concerned about the horror there, are those movements going to grow? Are those movements going to converge and become a power together? Let me give an example right now, because people wonder, oh, that's a pie in the sky. The last national election in France, which was literally a few weeks ago, saw a remarkable development in a country not that different from the United States. Four different left-wing political parties. The French Socialist Party, the French Communist Party, the French Green Party, and the largest of them, a party known as France Unbowed, led by a Marxist, former communist, Jean-Luc Mélenchon. They ran for office. They're now the number one political party in France. They have the largest number of seats. Mr. Macron, who we hear is the leader of France, came in third out of three major parties. He's finished politically, and the left, when it unified, is now in a dominant, powerful position in the French government. And this is not pie in the sky and not fanciful notion. If the left in the United States can overcome its narrowness, its division into too many little groups, and it can become focused, it will be the determinant of whether any fascism takes root again in the United States or whether instead capitalism will have to find an alternative way to solve its problems rather than to degenerate into a fascism the way it did when it couldn't solve its problems in Italy or France or Spain or Japan in the last century that we saw with such devastating effects. That's the issue. That's why what happens on the left in the United States is a crucial. And the understanding that capitalism is the problem is why not only why I wrote the book, but why I thought it could contribute to an overcoming of what's holding back the best bet we have to prevent fascism.
Richard Wolff, it's been terrific having you on Law and Disorder. Before we have to go, can you tell people how can they get your book, Understanding Capitalism, and how can people keep up with your work?
Well, the answer to both questions is the same, and it's very simple. Just go to our website, and it's called democracyatwork.info. That's all one word, democracy at work, no punctuation, democracyatwork.info. There you will find out about the new book, Understanding Capitalism, and everything else we do to make these arguments and to disseminate them globally.
Well, my goodness. Richard Wolff, again, we thank you so much. It's always the pleasure to have you here on Law and Disorder. Thank you for being with us again and for so clearly and passionately explaining what is at stake.
Okay, and my hat's off to both of you and all of you for maintaining this program. It's one of the ways to get these issues put on the table, which is more necessary now than ever before.
Richard Wolf, a million thanks for being on Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
You too. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The rise of Donald Trump and his MAGA supporters has transformed American politics, perhaps more than anything has since the gathering of forces of the rebellious slave owners in the South a century and a half ago. His first 4 years in office were chaotic, uninformed programmatically, and not animated by any kind of cadre of capable administrators. It was instead full of his statements and actions that many critics deemed to be racist, sexist, and xenophobic. He lost the election in 2020, although he did receive 74 million votes. And as he runs for the presidency again, this time he is talking, well, rather openly about wanting dictatorial authority, if indeed he is elected. And this time, if he does win, he now also has the aid of the right-wing Heritage Foundation, which has produced that 900-page Project 2025 document on how to radically change our country so as to make it far, far more conservative, provide far fewer rights to the American people, and allow any president so inclined to run the country as a virtual dictator. He has the financial support of a number of billionaires. He has an authoritarian right-wing Supreme Court, which in its latest decision, aptly named Donald Trump versus the United States of America, has given the presidency carte blanche immunity and placed him above the law, allowing the president to do almost anything he or she might want to do as long as it's deemed to be an official presidential act. And so today's program is the lead-off to a series of shows about fascism. Experts will discuss what it is, how it can be resisted, and how one organizes to make that resistance meaningful. We're going to start this series with today's guest, who is Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges is a wise and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and a moral and political philosopher as well. He has written a book entitled American Fascism. So we will ask Chris how he defines American fascism and, again, how we can fight against it to be sure that we can save our troubled democracy. Chris Hedges, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, you covered the Christian right for 2 years and wrote a book titled American Fascists. Who were these American fascists that you were identifying? Did Christian nationalism play a part in this? Talk to us about that.
So let me go back a little bit. I grew up in the church. My father was a Presbyterian minister. My mother was a professor, but a seminary graduate. I graduated from Harvard Divinity School, so I'm steeped in the Bible. I have biblical literacy. I understand the church, how it works. And in my last year at Harvard, I had a tutorial. This was with an emeritus professor named James Uther Adams. It was kind of built on the British system where he would take two final year students and work with them. And he had been in Germany at the University of Heidelberg. He was bilingual in German in 1935 and 1936. He'd actually been in the lecture hall with Heidegger giving the Nazi salute. So don't let anyone ever tell you that Heidegger didn't begin his lectures that way. And he dropped out of the university and joined the underground confessing church. That was the church run by Niemöller, Karl Barth, Albert Schweitzer. They called out the traditional mainstream church for not denouncing fascism, but they also watched the rise of the so-called German Christian church, which was pro-Nazi. And Adams, so this was in the early 1980s, saw in the rise of the Christian right, Christian nationalism in the United States, echoes of that so-called German Christian church, which was fascist, which had the Nazi flag on one side of the altar and the German flag on the other, or the Christian flag or whatever it was. So he was the first person to call these people Christian fascists. He was 80 years old when I had him, and I remember him saying to me that when we were his age, we would all be fighting the Christian fascists. These are heretics. These are people who have sacralized the worst elements of white supremacy, American capitalism, American imperialism, by distorting the biblical message. That was the book now is, I think, 18 years old or something. It was a very unpopular position to take at the time, because the liberal church was attempting to engage in dialogue with these figures like Falwell and others. But of course, there was no real interest. In fact, one of my professors at Harvard invited Falwell to come speak, and I worked with the GBLT community at Harvard to shut down all the streets around the Kennedy School where he spoke. Well, all Falwell did was, in essence, flip the middle finger at Harvard while his cameras rolled. It was a great fundraising technique. He had no interest in dialogue at all. And this movement is what was one that was nascent. When I was a divinity student, I was overseas for 20 years, but I came back and it had exploded to the point where, of course, in many of the senior positions in the Trump administration were filled by these figures, Mike Pence, Barr, Betsy DuBois, and others. And it functions as any totalitarian movement functions. It engages in magical thinking. This Hannah Arendt argues that this is a fundamental element of all totalitarianism. It preys on the despair and alienation and even rage of its adherents. It's cultish, and Trump functions far more as a cult figure for his followers than as a political figure. It has all of the attributes. And when you look at studies of fascism, like Robert Paxton's book, Anatomy of Fascism, or Fritz Stern's The Politics of Cultural Despair, or other books like that, they always talk about how fascism, when it rises, uses the familiar comforting symbols that are indigenous to the culture. So German fascism, which was grounded in Teutonic myths, didn't look like Italian fascism, which harkened back to ancient Rome. And as Paxton said, when fascism comes to America, it will be with mass recitations of the Pledge of Allegiance and the Christian cross and the flag. And that's precisely what's happened. So that's what I spent 2 years on the book. I spent a lot of time with these people, which was the only way to fully understand them. But what I found fascinating, I was always upfront about who I was and where I came from. As soon as they knew that I was biblically literate, they never wanted to talk about the Bible with me. And the reason is because they don't know the Bible. They know those sections of it that they've been fed to buttress their ideology, but they don't really know it at all. And it is all of these mega churches, pastors who are often, when they're successful, millionaires and private jets and everything else, are cult figures. They can't be challenged. They are in direct contact with God. And Trump just became that figure writ large, in fact, to the detriment of many of the mega pastors, because they transferred that kind of localized authority or complete authority over their adherents to Trump. I saw it coming. I understood the danger of it. And I understood, I didn't predict a Trump, but I certainly predicted or saw the rise of a demagogue out of this movement, and that's precisely what happened.
And your book is now 18 years old, as you mentioned, but it seems to me, and so I want to ask you, what makes it so relevant today? Is it the Trump phenomena, the fact that now there is that phenomena, the Make America Great slogans and the Trumpism, cultism that goes with it? Talk to us about the relevancy of it today. More so, should we be more alarmed today even than you were at 18 years ago?
Well, definitely we should be more alarmed, because these people are on the cusp of taking power. And a second Trump administration won't look like a first. It'll be far more vindictive. And Trump was just mercurial and impulsive and disorganized. That isn't going to happen this time. Well, I think it's an important book because it explains the pathology of the Christian right, why they do what they do. I mean, just a small example, I went to a Right to Life Week weekend in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. And again, I know as a reporter, for many years for the New York Times, that you can't understand these movements unless you spend hours and hours on the ground talking to the people who are involved in them. So this Right to Life weekend, there are about 400 women. They asked at the beginning for all the post-abortive sisters to stand, and almost the whole room stood. And when I started doing interviews, it wasn't that they had had an abortion. Many of them had multiple abortions. And they would take these people off, they take them off for weekends, and they give them plastic dolls and tell them these are the children they've murdered, and they have to dress the doll and bathe the doll and name the doll, and at the end of the weekend beg for forgiveness and vow to fight the culture of death, which is us. You know, there was that insight into the manipulation of guilt and despair to essentially recruit people to fight against the secular humanist society. I mean, that's a window into the so-called Right to Life movement that you don't get if you don't spend time with them. I took a seminar in Missouri, a creationist seminar. So they were teaching teachers in Christian schools, quote-unquote Christian schools, how to teach about creationism, about the creation, which is supposedly literally true from Genesis. Well, the problem is that, according to the Bible, the sun or light is not created until the fourth day. So do you spend the first 4 days in complete and utter darkness? And the teacher said, well, tell the students that God created a temporary light. Well, that's not in the Bible. But it is in those kinds of details that you see the irrationality. The rapture is not in the Bible. It's not there. When you put that ideology under a microscope, when you look at it with those kinds of details, you see how frighteningly, irrational it is, and how it is really about the perpetuation of magical thinking. And that, I did walk away, the first chapter of the book is despair, because these people have been through it. They've lost their jobs, they've been evicted. I didn't put it in the book because it was anecdotal, but almost every woman that I interviewed had suffered sexual or domestic abuse, struggles with addictions, opioid addictions, alcoholism, gambling. And so that secular world almost destroyed them. And that's engenders the rage against that world. So I was in an end times gathering with Tim LaHaye, who wrote this very popular series. And by the way, just on the New York Times bestseller list, they exclude quote-unquote Christian books because it's a genre. But if they didn't, those would be the top 10 best-selling books. Oh, they would all come out of Christian nationalism. And it was this blood-curdling, very graphic description of people's heads exploding and blood gushing out of their eyes kind of stuff at the end time. So when the Armageddon comes and the Antichrist returns and et cetera, and, which all prefaces supposedly the return of the Messiah. And I realized that these people really hate the world outside the walls of that church and want to see it destroyed. There's an apocalyptic vision there that is very, very frightening. When you look closely at their lives and what has happened to them, you understand why they feel that way. But it's very, at the conclusion of the book is that either these people who have been marginalized and pushed aside, especially through deindustrialization, either they are reintegrated into American society or we are finished. That's how I conclude the book, which I still feel is true.
And you've made the point that there's been an advance of Christian nationalism since you wrote the book, a further advance, a further entrenchment of it in so many of the laws in this country, including in what's going on in the schools. Let's talk then and turn our conversation then to the question of, well, what does one do? How does one fight that growing fascistic nature of the American body politic? You wrote in your book that that what we lack at that time, what you called, I think, a countervailing force. What's an example of that, and how could we help create a more effective countervailing force?
We're not going to argue these people out of irrational belief. We're not going to argue them out of creationism or a narrative that is not based on verifiable fact or science. It isn't going to work. The only way is to give them the kind of economic, social stability that has plunged them into this kind of despair and seen them grasp at this kind of magical thinking in order to endure. And this is the common denominator for all forms of totalitarianism, including traditional fascism. It is built, I mean, this is the whole thesis of Fritz Stern. I knew Fritz Stern. He left Nazi Germany when he was 18 as a refugee, taught at Columbia. But this is the whole thesis of his book, The Politics of Cultural Despair. And also Hannah Arendt picks up on that theme. So we have to address the social pathologies that have pushed people into the arms of these very frightening figures. And we're not doing that. The Democratic Party is ignoring it. The mercenary nature of the healthcare system, the skyrocketing utilities, you know, in our towns and cities, which have been sold off to private interests, rising food prices, the wage stagnation, the refusal to raise the minimum wage significantly, the breaking of unions. These are the conditions that create fascist totalitarian movements, and we're ignoring them. In fact, of course, the Democratic Party tends to demonize those figures. Not that they're not potentially frightening, not that the movement is not frightening, it is, but it's not addressed. I mean, if you go back and look at Weimar Germany before the 1929 global crash, the Nazis were polling in the single digits, I don't know, 4% or something. Well, what happened after the 29 crash is that the Weimar government took out all sorts of loans, international loans, to keep the economy afloat, but they sacrificed the working class. They actually suspended employment insurance for millions of Germans. And, of course, what happened is this thrust destitute, desperate Germans into the arms of fascist movements. You had a countervailing communist movement, largely in the urban centers, and you had strong unions. It was a different kind of social dynamic, and the Nazis, of course, as soon as they took power, set out to crush that opposition, which they did, unfortunately, successfully. But it's the same dynamic, and we're not addressing the root causes that cause people to embrace these figures and rally around these cult-like politicians like Trump. And honestly, if it wasn't Trump, it would be someone else. You know, I think too often the liberal class or liberals tend to demonize Trump as if Trump is the problem. Trump is the symptom. Trump is not the disease. And we're not addressing the disease. And that's the whole point of my book.
Yes. You're making it clear, I think, that we also then need a new independent movement or independent party, a new party of our own. Talk to us about that if we can't look to either of the capitalist parties for the relief that is needed if fascism is not to run the day. How do we go about doing that? It's difficult, certainly. Many people have tried this before. What is your own thinking on how we go about creating the kind of countervailing force to those two parties so as to prevent what is happening?
Well, the two parties have conspired ever since Ross Perot to essentially block independent and third-party candidates. They do that primarily through making ballot access almost impossible, and I know because I worked with Ralph Nader. I was Ralph Nader's speechwriter, so I saw what they did. Presidential campaigns cost $1 billion, and you're just denied media access. You're not permitted to participate in the debates. You're shut out. The media is a kind of echo chamber for the system. When they do talk about third-party figures, whether it's Nader, Jill Stein, Cornel West, anyone else, they ridicule them and demon if they get mentioned at all. So that. And Teresa Armato wrote a good book. The name of the book escapes me. She was Ralph's, she's quite a brilliant attorney in her own right, but she ran Ralph's campaign. But she wrote about all of the hurdles and impediments and obstacles that the two parties together put up to block any kind of third-party movement. And that has really hurt us tremendously. And that's by design. I think the other big issue are unions. And this is why you have Shama Sawant, the former socialist city councilwoman in Seattle, trying to build militant movements. I mean, the only power we have comes through organized entities, grassroots entities, but in particular organized labor, because the capacity to strike is the only capacity we have to essentially cripple the system and make the system begin to address our demands. So you have 11% of the workforce in the United States is unionized. I think 6% of that is in the public sector. When the railroad freight workers, when they threatened to strike, Biden invoked I think it's called the Railroad Act, I can't remember the exact name, to essentially make the strike illegal. which kind of throws the lie that he's the most pro-union president, you know, going. And so the mechanisms by which we once, including, I think, an independent and a free media, you go back and look at public broadcasting 2, 3, 4 decades ago, you could see figures like Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn and even Malcolm X. That's all gone because, of course, they've slashed the funding and the corporate donors keep both public radio and public television alive, and they have to cater to their donor class like every other news organization. So there's been, the media is atrophied. You know, the range of acceptable opinion is kind of narrowed from A to B, to steal a line from Dorothy Parker when she talked about Katharine Hepburn's emotional range as an actor. The health of our democracy is dire. The mechanisms by which we could reform it and address injustices have essentially been shut down through corporate power. Sheldon Wolin, I cite him all the time, but he's important. In his book, Democracy Incorporated, elucidates that. He died a few years ago. And I did the last interview with him, which is on YouTube. It's 3 hours long. He taught at Berkeley, taught at Princeton, Cornell West mentor. But we've undergone a corporate coup d'etat in slow motion. And it's over. They've won. These people have deformed the system to create the most grotesque and pronounced inequality in American history. They have designed a system by which money is funneled upwards, including, of course, slashing tax rates for corporations. I think, a year or two ago, Amazon didn't pay any taxes. I think it actually got money back. And this rapacious billionaire class, so these figures, $180, $200 billion these individuals are worth. So, I mean, you read Aristotle, and he said that when you have that kind of social inequality, your only two options are tyranny or revolution. And we're well on the road to tyranny in the guise of Christian fascism.
And in terms of then what is needed to prevent that, that's the question. And of course, it's no doubt, as you've just described, how difficult that fight back effort would be. Do you take any encouragement at all from the fact that, public opinion polling shows that the younger people in America today prefer, for example, a socialist economy as opposed to a capitalist economy? The changing demographics of the country itself and what sometimes that portends. Do you think that before America would become a fully embedded fascistic country, there is the expectation in your mind, or the hope in your mind, or the possibility at least in your mind, that that could be prevented?
The problem is that we've been disempowered. I mean, that goes all the way back to the McCarthyite smears. Ellen Schrecker wrote two good books on this. And they purged the American system. Cold War liberalism, of course, distorts the very notion of liberalism. We're not organized. I mean, I take hope in the consciousness, especially of the young, who have been, we know, completely abandoned by the system. I mean, they can't find work, meaningful work. They can't afford a house. They've been essentially pushed out of the system. So yes, there is a consciousness, but we have to build the kind of militant organizations that can begin to shut down and cripple the system. And we don't have them. And that's what worries me. So if you look at the 1930s, what happened in the United States economically and what happened in Europe was very similar, but the responses were very different. Why? Because we had powerful militant labor organizations in the U.S., along with an independent press, much of it driven by the Communist Party, which we've written out of U.S. history, largely, and it frightened the ruling elites. I mean, Roosevelt, FDR, said his greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. And I've read his private correspondence to his brother, and there's a fascinating letter early on in the 30s where he said, we have to begin to address this, the poverty and the unemployment, otherwise we'll get revolution. That's his word. And of course, the specter of the 1917 revolution in Russia and the rise of the Bolsheviks terrifies the capitalist class. And so that's how that is the impetus, along with all sorts of, like the GM sit-down strikes and everything else, that pushes Roosevelt to create a government jobs program. 12 million people are employed, public works, the WPA, along with Social Security, along with the 8-hour workday. But it didn't come because of the kindness or goodness of the ruling class. It became because they're frightened, which is always how it works. And we have been effectively disarmed. We've been effectively, are the movements and organizations we had by which we could protect our own rights have essentially been taken from us. And that worries me. So without those countervailing forces, it becomes far easier for fascistic programs and entities, parties to achieve power. So yes, the consciousness is there, but we lack the organizational structures to pit power against power.
So therefore, what should we do? What can we do?
Rebuild them as fast as we can. And that means stepping outside the system. It means union organizing. It means refusing to participate. I mean, you know, I covered Gaza, you know, for 7 years. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. I cannot vote for anyone who supports genocide. I mean, I've lost friends. Others have disappeared. I just came back from the Middle East. I was there all summer. I speak Arabic, but I was doing a refresher course because I'm going to do my next book on Gaza with the cartoonist Joe Sacco. I have just too many Palestinian friends. I can't, you know, in every way. So I think we have to draw red lines that we won't cross. If enough people step outside the system will begin to get worried and the system will begin to respond. But that's what we have to do.
Well, I was thinking of during Vietnam, and what it took was many, many years, of course, of the slow and then sometimes more rapid growth of a massive movement that finally made it basically impossible, along with the victories of the Vietnamese on the battlefield, of course, the Viet Cong on the battlefield, for the United States government to carry on that imperialist war.
People forget. I mean, the civil rights movement, when was the first? I think Rosa Parks was on the bus in, what was it, 1954? It takes, I just spent 14 years fighting for the freedom of Julian Assange, but it took 14 years.
Well, Chris Hedges, then, a final thought or two, and then how can people follow your work?
I think we have to regain the kind of militancy. Remember, we are now facing the rise of an extremist, I would call it fascistic, movement that potentially could seize power with a Trump administration, a personality cult. We have the numbers. And on chrishedges.substack.com, I also have on YouTube a YouTube channel where I now do my show after being pushed out of the Real News for my frequent criticisms of Joe Biden and the Biden administration over the genocide in Gaza.
That's what happens when you're honest in America these days. Chris Hedges, I can't thank you enough, really. Thank you so much for your work, your wonderful work, and for taking time to join us here on Law and Disorder.
Not at all. I'm happy to do it.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.